welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Suicide has been around everywhere and forever. What have we learned about it? With a nod to World Suicide Prevention Day tomorrow, we've invited three guests to the show to talk about that. Coming up later is Jack Marshall. He's a former television news anchor of some 33 years in northeastern Ohio. He suffered with depression for many years, and the stigmas kept him from seeking treatment. Right now, we have two former longtime volunteers and now employees of the North Central Mental Health Suicide Prevention Services. Coordinator Mary Brennan Hoffman is with us. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thank you.
I should say welcome back to the show. You were with us before. And also, Assistant Coordinator Rick Bauman. Rick, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Mary, you've had a long history in the field of suicide prevention, but you've also been on both ends of the crisis hotline. You attempted suicide while experiencing an episode of major depressive disorder as a young woman. How did you seek help at the time?
Well, at the time, I actually did call a hotline several times, and that did kind of help me a little bit. And then I had experience with a counselor, but I wasn't actually being treated for depression at the time. And after I made the suicide attempt, I got really good help. I started on medication. I had a variety of counseling and went through a fairly long residential program, just kind of getting myself back together.
How many years ago was that?
That was 1985, so over 20.
A lot has changed.
Yes, for me personally.
Well, in the field.
Yes, I absolutely. A lot has changed. The number one thing I think is that people are more willing to talk about suicide, and I think there's a greater awareness that it's a problem that really affects so many people and families.
How do you know that people are more willing to talk about it, or that you're just around more people that are willing to talk about it?
Well, the Surgeon General in 90 whatever, six or so, did announce and make a public statement that suicide was a public health problem. So, you know, we have that record. Mm-hmm. There are coalitions all over the country that are people who are not just in the mental health field, but in all different areas who are affected in some way. And these coalitions have just popped up like mushrooms, and they're all over with people talking about it, finding out what people are doing about it. And then there's a lot more, I think, promotion even nationally with the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That's kind of gotten a lot more publicity. So I think we see a lot more just mention of it, talk about it, and of what's being done, which is, the resources for people who are suicidal.
It sort of begins with the stigma of what leads up to attempted or successful suicides, which often is depression.
Absolutely.
Or any kind of mental illness.
Right, right.
Any progress on that front?
Stigma is one of those issues that's very persistent, but I do feel like we've made some progress. And part of it is more people sharing about, that they have experienced it and they got through it. And I think if you kind of look in the media, we find, advertisements for antidepressants and anxiety, which, you never saw those even 10 years ago.
That's an interesting way to look at those. Some people, it bothers them that they're advertising prescription drugs
right.
on the television.
Right.
But it does open up the rest of the world to the fact that there must be a lot of people out there suffering from it, or they wouldn't have it on national television.
Right, exactly. And we know they're, prescribing more medication for depression. I mean, that's just increased steadily over the years. And that is an indication that more people are at least seeking treatment and getting one form of treatment.
You were getting counseling at the time, but you were not diagnosed with depression, or at least you
No.
weren't being treated for it. What was,
No.
was the suicide attempt the tipping point for you in your treatment, or?
Yes, I think what happened for me was that when the counseling wasn't working and I still felt pretty much just as bad and, I had all the symptoms and I wasn't getting any help for the not being able to sleep, the loss of appetite, just feeling hopeless, that I just felt, well, even if this isn't working, then there must be no other way out. That's how I was feeling.
My guest is Mary Brennan Hoffman. She is the coordinator for the North Central Mental Health Suicide Prevention Services. Also with us is Rick Bauman. He is assistant coordinator for suicide prevention services at North Central Mental Health. Coming up in a little while, Jack Marshall. He is a stigma buster for the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, and he'll be coming up at later on in the show. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. I have posted those both of those numbers, the hotline numbers, there if you want to check that out. Mary, you were very young. Yes. How old were you when you attempted suicide?
I think 28.
Now, it's always surprising to see this statistic. It never fails to surprise me that suicide is the third leading cause of death for young people aged 15 to 24. And I'm sure it's not much of a different statistic when you get to 28. It's probably very comparable. Why such a high rate among a category that, I don't know, often is probably stereotypically assigned with a sense of hope in looking to the future?
Sure. I think part of it is the whole hormone issue with, you know, adolescents. They're experiencing a lot of, you know, change, and their relationships are very, you know, tumultuous, and there's lots of emotional, you know, kind of turmoil at the time. But I also think one reason, and over the years, you know, I've had pretty good, you know, that, yeah, this probably is a reason, is they don't have a history of having gotten through things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they have a breakup with a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and it does feel like the end of the world to them. You know, once you hit 30, 40, and you've had, you know, three relationships that broke up and you got through it, I think, you know, you just have some experience to kind of fall back on, that's definitely part of it. Also, I think that we are having a lot of adolescents and young adults who are dealing with depression, which, you know, many of the major mental illnesses start to show up in the late adolescents and early adults. So that's kind of happening. And it's very frightening when you experience a you know, schizophrenia or a bipolar episode, because you don't know what's happening and you're afraid that, you know, something's wrong with you. And I think especially for young adults who are sort of deciding who they are, it can be pretty traumatic.
Rick, you first became involved in the cause of suicide prevention in 1992. You became a volunteer with Suicide Prevention Services, and that was 2 years after your teenage son attempted suicide. What inspired you during that two-year period to then volunteer? It wasn't immediate.
Okay. Well, when my son attempted suicide, suicide was something, and a suicide attempt that happened to somebody else, not to me. Mm-hmm. I wasn't, just caught me completely off guard. I have four other children, and he was the youngest. And it's been my experience in life when something that was very important to me, I wanted to learn it, and it was a factor in their well-being. I wanted to learn as much as I could. So I read and looked around, and then it just so happened there was an ad in our church bulletin about they wanted volunteers for suicide prevention. And I said, that's what I want to do. And I did join as a volunteer in 1992. You know, this program with North Central Mental Health it just worked out with we have, you know, the 50 hours of training, and I learned as much as I could about preventing suicide. And it just being able to work the line and talking to people that had lost hope and being able to feel that you did some, you know, you kept them around longer with some hope and some hope for the future with, you know, some kind of resource that would help them in whatever crisis they were going through right now. It worked for me.
When you would be answering the line, did you hear from young people that reminded you of your son?
Oh, yeah. No, yes. And the one commonality is they don't see any hope. They're just living in the pain that they're in today, and our goal is to get them through today with some hope for the future, with, you know, a resource that helps them through the crisis that they're in.
How do you train somebody to answer a hotline? It seems like one of the most critical jobs there ever was.
We teach them to listen.
That's the big part, right?
That is the big part.
We have our training is pretty extensive. It's 50 hours. We do a lot of role playing of actual calls, so people get the experience of being the caller, which I think is really important because, you know, what helps me, you know, when someone's listening, and they get the experience of being the volunteer. We have about a dozen very experienced group leaders who share their experience and are really good at, you know, bringing out the best in the volunteers. Really, you know, if we have someone who is compassionate and they're willing to learn, we can train them. But yeah, it's pretty intense.
Do most folks have personal experience with suicide attempts or suicide in their family? Is that pretty common or not necessarily?
It's pretty common. I'm going to see if you're going to say. It is pretty common. We kind of have two groups. One are people that have had, you know, depression themselves or family members or lost someone. The other group is we have a good number of students who are interested in the field of counseling. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, we actually have the first-year OSU Medical College students come in because they can learn something that even if they're not going into psychiatry or whatever, it's something that's going to help them in their future as physicians. So we do get a lot of students that want that kind of experience.
So when someone calls into a suicide hotline, are they being counseled or are they being listened to? I know a good counselor often is also a good listener.
Actually, no. We don't. Their family and friends and everybody's already told them what they should do and whatever. And I think the factor that we just listen and we'll even actually repeat a lot of things they say so they know, wow, they're listening to me. They know what I've said. Mm-hmm. And they kind of go on and they feel more comfortable and safe to share some things with us that we're able to point it out to them and let them know, what do you think? Do you think this would help you? And we get them actually to be part of the treatment plan. We want them to be part of what's going to be healing for them. And that's really, I think that's, to me, that's what makes it work.
Yeah, it's more, certainly more sort of crisis intervention oriented than counseling because we don't get into their past history. Really, we're just trying to find out, like Rick said, you know, what's got them feeling so bad today, connect with them so they feel some support, and then maybe, you know, refer them to a long-term, you know, maybe counselor if that's something they're open to.
Okay, we have to take a break. It is World Suicide Prevention Day tomorrow. That's what we're talking about today. I hope you can join us if you have a question or comment. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks for joining us. At 1 o'clock on point, we'll be here. And is it time to remake American higher education? Columbia's Mark Taylor says it's time to end tenure and bring on a revolution. He'll join On Point at 1 o'clock this afternoon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Go behind the scenes with WOSU with our e-newsletters. Find out what our classical music hosts are listening to. Get the latest news from NPR and the WOSU newsroom. And learn about volunteer opportunities. Visit WOSU.org/email and sign up for one of our e-newsletters. And it's 59 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today and a high of 73 degrees. Clear skies tonight, a low of 48. Sunshine for Friday and a high of 75. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Rick, your son eventually took his own life. I'm very sorry for that. How have you incorporated that into your mission since it happened?
Well, it's made my passion deeper, if there is such a thing. When my son took his life, there again, I'm looking for a way to be more helpful. And North Central actually hired me, and I was able to get a survivor of suicide support group going at North Central. And it's been helpful to me just to, there again, I think that what makes it work is when you're down and out, the best thing you can do is go help somebody else. I mean, it works. It works for me. And it's just to see the pain that's left behind. You know, I've thought about this. What do you say about survivors of suicide? The statistics say, and the research says, that people that attempt suicide are in psychological pain, psych pain. So in the position I'm in now, I said, well, that must be some kind of a where you can someone else can catch it. So they leave behind a survivor that now has psych pain that goes on and on and on. It's really kind of peculiar in that way. So you have to figure out a way to live one day at a time with that psych pain.
So you don't pass it on.
Yes, exactly.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. How do parents – I know there's this phrase, gatekeepers, and it's really, really critical. And Rick, actually, you mentioned earlier that usually people who call the hotline have already listened to other people telling them what to do. And I guess I've always sort of thought of the hotlines as something is anonymous, that you don't have to talk to somebody you know and you can go to it anonymously, but you're saying they actually often – they've already tried other things and it is a crisis situation. It isn't about a lack of being uninformed. But how do other people become gatekeepers as well? And can you first, I guess, define what a gatekeeper is?
I was going to say, really,
fighting over the mic in here.
A gatekeeper can really be anyone who's in a position to notice that something's going wrong. So basically, we're all gatekeepers. Certainly, there are some people who are in positions like high school teachers. You know, they see these kids every day. They can notice changes. They see their schoolwork. So they're in a position to recognize that something's wrong and then to reach out. So that's basically what a gatekeeper is.
And so teachers, resident assistants in the dormitories, pastors, imams, you know, you name it, anybody.
Doctors. Yeah.
Now, they say that most – I think it was 75% of older people who commit suicide have seen a physician in the past year.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons we're so thrilled to be training, you know, about 30 new doctors every year, so that when they go to their practices, they're not afraid to talk to the people more, you know, if they are worried, to ask directly, you know, about suicide and just to be more aware of depression, too. It's important.
Yeah, Rick?
Oh, this comment was on the back to the callers. Mm-hmm. I think what helps them be able and free to call is they're still in control. All they got to do is hang up. So it kind of gives them, well, I have a little bit of control of this. Whereas with their friends,
they won't shut up. And
yes.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think that's what makes it work. They feel comfortable that, and then after we are able to engage them and try to sell them the hope that we want to sell them, that they just, it feels more open and we know it works.
You
know,
is it really different with every person, or do you see patterns? And do the patterns revolve around age or gender or?
The only commonality is that they're in a crisis, and the rest. After as many hours as I've had talking to people, every time I think I've heard every scenario, that I haven't heard every scenario. There's a different scenario for everyone. Everyone, you know, one crisis for one person is not a crisis for another.
Yeah, it's very individual. I mean, like you said, that, you know, the common threads are they've lost hope, they feel trapped, they feel like they're a burden to their family, they're in pain. But the levels of pain, you know, vary, the situations vary, and how you handle them. You know, we certainly never use say the same thing to everyone kind of thing. And that's why we're always happy to get such a diverse group of volunteers, because our callers are diverse.
So if somebody calls in, how do you change who's going – does somebody screen the calls first to see who might be the right? It's just who picks up the phone.
Basically, if there's more than one person in the phone room, they really take turns.
Mm-hmm.
There's no screening or whatever.
Okay. Yeah, everyone's that we train is ready to take what comes on. Now, occasionally we'll get someone like maybe a woman who's been sexually assaulted, and they'll say, you know, can I talk to a woman? And we always accommodate if they're asking something like that. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't happen that often. Most of the time people are so happy just to hear a caring voice that, you know, they're not picky.
614-292-8513. We do have somebody who called in. They didn't want to talk on the phone, but they had a question. How do we deal with suicides caused by societal constructs like gender and sexuality? Is it true that at least half of transgender people have committed or attempted to commit suicide by age 30?
We definitely know that gender orientation issues are a significant risk factor for attempts, absolutely. And certainly there are things in society and you know, prejudices and cultural bias and where people feel rejected for whatever reason, if it's because, you know, their race, if it's because of their gender orientation, if they're different. And people who feel rejected, who feel isolated and alone, are at a risk. So certainly, you know, when you can improve, acceptance in general, you're going to have less of a suicide risk, I think, for those folks.
A lot of parents, they know their kids might be at risk for something. They, in a million years, would never imagine suicide, but maybe they don't want their kid to get counseling, or it's not that bad. They couldn't possibly do that because it's going to reflect badly on them, they think. Is that a problem? And what do you tell folks like that who are saying, well, my kid's not that bad?
Well, that's the more that you learn about it, the more you know how important it is to get counseling or whatever. It's always a struggle. I know we had a horrible struggle with our son to get therapy and take medication. It was a battle all the way through. It's difficult, but when they are using the medication and they're going to a therapist and they're trying to address whatever their issue is, that they dysfunction, it works.
Yeah, there's certainly a concern, you know, they don't want their child labeled or whatever, and that's kind of going back to the stigma issue. Mm-hmm. So I think if we can, and there's a big movement in NAMI, when you talk to Jack, he'll confirm this, that, depression and bipolar disorder, mental illness is just as real as, other illnesses. So I have a daughter with diabetes, and, you know, I wouldn't hesitate to get her help because, you know, it's a medical problem and it's, you know, very dangerous. And I think when parents can realize that, you know, depression is a treatable illness just like asthma or whatever, and if you don't treat it, it has some potentially serious consequences, that it's kind of how you frame it, I think, for parents. And to say, you know, the other thing is, you know, it's not like necessarily that the person is going to be, you know, branded for life or always be, you know, in a bad shape. I mean, there's so many people who are depressed and who are very functional and who have it under control or who have, you know, are in recovery. Same with like substance abuse. Mm-hmm. And you can, you know, go on and live a very productive, happy life.
I was surprised to see a statistic, too, that depression is the number one disability in the world. That was...
it is kind of bizarre.
Kind of shocking.
And the money lost, you know, when they do the cost analysis
right.
thing, it's just billions and billions of dollars. I think it's just, you know, anxiety and depression are a lot more common than people realize. And if you don't get treatment and don't get effective treatment, they can be extremely disabling and debilitating.
I guess in a way, too, it's the kind of thing, though, that you don't – because you don't see it, it's the measuring of what is lost by not treating it is probably very difficult to make.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of people who, you know, if pushed against the wall and you say, well, have you ever taken a mental health day, you know, a day where you just felt so bad and it wasn't because you had the flu – you know, and certainly, you know, depression is a much more long-term thing. But, mm-hmm. you know, people can accept that and say, yeah. So there's a lot of missed work because of, you know, a mental illness, you know, Probably.
And I thought you were going to take the other tack when you said that. Have you ever taken a mental health day? A lot of people don't. They would never take a mental health day. They would never allow themselves a day off from work because they're very stressed out or very anxious or very depressed.
Yeah.
So they walk right back into the stress. Mm-hmm. I think stress is, you know, they say depression, but they're not addressing the perpetrator stress.
Because if you broke your leg, you'd take the day off.
Right.
But if you're feeling broken emotionally,
right.
If you broke your leg falling, you wouldn't go back up where you fell from.
Exactly. No, exactly. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Suicide rates are highest in the spring.
Yes.
Is that something you recognize in your organization and you have more people on?
Yeah. You know what? Although we can say, you know, certain things about the volume of calls and increases, like we can say definitely between 9 p.m. and 3 a.m. in the morning, we have more calls, although we've had very busy afternoons. But we get calls all seasons, and when you look at the suicides, you know, they are spread out. Yes, there are more in the spring, but it's, you know, fairly spread out. Actually, and I always find this kind of funny because most people think that suicide rates increase around the holidays, and they actually go down. Here in Franklin County, December is always, in the past, I don't know how many years, is almost always the lowest suicide.
There might
month.
Be a higher rate of depression, but a lower rate of actual suicides.
Right,
yeah.
Right, absolutely.
They say the spring, you know, all the flowers blooming and the trees turning green and everything, and there's all kind of beautiful things happening, but a depressed person, it's so contrary to what they're feeling that they say, why don't I feel like this? Why don't I feel like everybody else? And it just puts them in deeper depression.
It just brings it out in more stark relief, what they're going through.
Yeah, that's certainly been.
There is a much higher rate of suicide among males and females, pretty much all the way down the line, 4 to 1. Is that, again, you think that's like a physiological? Is that what they've figured? Or there's different stresses that males? I mean, I know there's no pat answers for any
laughing,
of this, but
yeah,
well, you know.
Yeah. No, definitely this has been a very highly, you know, discussed, researched, et cetera. And one of the things certainly is the method, choice of method, because men do choose, you know, more dangerous methods.
Okay.
You know,
they're just more successful because of the method.
That's part of it.
Okay.
But why are they choosing more violent methods? You know, why are men more susceptible to homicide? You know, it's the levels of aggression.
Men are just
and
more
anger.
Violent, right, Rick?
Okay.
Well,
there we go.
Just kidding.
The thing they say is that we have a more difficult time asking for help.
That's definitely.
And we have a more aggressive nature.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that.
Like the asking for directions when you mean asking for help.
Exactly.
Okay.
And they do know, too, that men also have they've done some research on the fact that men are less likely to identify their symptoms of depression. So, you know, women, I feel depressed. Maybe I need to get some help. And the man, you know, I'm just having a bad day. You know, it's because the OSU Buckeyes
lost. Well, women more tend to talk to their friends about
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
That may be a point of relationship for
sure.
A lot of women is talking about being down. Newspaper obituaries rarely mention suicide as the cause of death. How do you feel about that? Sometimes when they say you can give contributions to
mental health center
or central or something like that, you maybe that's a clue. And sometimes I used to think when they said died suddenly, but that's not always the case because lots of times that's from people being in an accident. What about that? Because there's no bigger communicator than the newspapers and the media, but they're often the least willing because of the stigma. Or not the stigma, but kind of the taboo, I guess, is the better.
That's what I wanted to do when my son, when he did die. I put right in there, you can make donations to suicide prevention. I'm trying to get the word out to everywhere that I can. That's why I go out and do talks at high schools, middle school, colleges, wherever they'll ask me to come and talk. And just to get the word out and so people, we can remove that stigma of talking about suicide. Hey, it is a cause of death. We should try to prevent it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's just the stigma and the taboo. And, you know, families, you know, still feel sometimes that, you know, there's shame or that they're going to be blamed. Or it's a much more complicated kind of grief situation, I think, than an accidental death or, you know, cancer.
Mm-hmm. And I know the dispatch, when there's a known suicide and it's part of the news, they're now putting The hotline in the paper, is that helpful? I mean, do you notice an uptick sometimes or not necessarily? It's not something you follow.
It's definitely helpful, and it's recommended. The Center for Disease Controls recommends in any, you know, media presentation that the hotline numbers are available. I think we've gotten calls after, mm-hmm. you know, it's been in the paper. Actually, if it's been in the news, if it's been in the paper, if it's been on Oprah, mm-hmm. We do see, you know, peaks in the...
So it helps. It really does help.
It does help because we'll get what we call a third-party call, someone that's concerned about someone, and they saw the number and they want to know more about it, so what they can do to their help, how they can help their loved one. So it does help in that way.
And you get those kind of calls at the hotline as well.
Yes. Okay.
We have a question from Joy, another person didn't want to talk. I teach college students, and sometimes they come to me distraught, telling me their friends are contemplating suicide or attempted suicide. What should I advise or tell them? Another gatekeeper question.
Right. If you're talking to the student themselves, it would be a wonderful thing if you're comfortable to ask them directly, you know, I'm really concerned about you. Is it getting to the point that you're thinking about suicide? That really gives the student the chance to start talking about it where they feel, you know, safe, that they're not going to get, you know, criticized or suffer from the consequences. The other thing is have them call a hotline right then and there where you got the student in your office. Have them call a hotline and they can talk to someone who can do a more thorough assessment and then connect them with a resource. Just connect them with the campus resources. OSU has a counseling center that if you're a student, you have free sessions and it's available. It's right there on campus. So get them to the counseling center. You know, be there with them till they make the call to get connected with help.
Yeah. We have to take a break. I'm going to read an email, though, before we do. It's from a listener. Regarding suicide by young people, I attempted suicide in eighth grade and again during my first year at college. Soon after, I was pronounced normal by a psychiatrist at OSU. I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. I knew I wasn't any more depressed than my friends. Recently, I've heard several references made about young people being unable to make good judgments because their prefrontal cortexes weren't fully developed. Prefrontal cortexes are responsible for sound decision-making, ability to consider consequences, and impulse control. I think this explains what my problem was. I was in what I considered to be a crisis situation under a lot of stress and made a very poor choice. I chose what I thought was the quickest and easiest way out of a problem I couldn't solve.
Wow. I've read those studies, too, about teenagers and young people not being fully, you know, brain developed. And having had two teenagers myself, I would concur. I think that, you know, if a person is thinking that suicide is the best way out, that it doesn't really matter what's wrong, if it's their brain or if it's their serotonin levels in their brain or whatever, you know, they need help because that's not a good way to deal with a problem and it's a very permanent thing. And the person gets past that and they're going to realize it. And, you know, thank goodness this young woman, you know, got past it.
The bottom line, I've done some presentations for TBI people, traumatic brain injuries, and the answer to the whole situation is someone that chooses to take their life, so their brain isn't working properly for whatever reason. They're not thinking rational. You know, the will to stay alive is pretty strong, so when whatever's causing you to think that death would be better is kind of an irrational decision. The cause, several different. You know.
And how many times do you try to tell a kid, you're not thinking clearly, and
yes.
they're the last one
right.
that's going to listen to you when you
right.
try to tell them that. So
absolutely.
We're going to have to take a break. We'll return, and Jack Marshall, the Ohio Stigma Buster, will join us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
See the new lineup of public affairs programming on Friday nights from WOSU-TV. Starting at 8 is Washington Week, followed by Columbus on the Record at 8:30. Continuing at 9 is the McLaughlin Group. And at 9:30, PBS presents Need to Know, a new program with an innovative broadcast and web approach to news gathering and reporting. Watch the new public affairs lineup every Friday night beginning at 8 on WOSU-TV.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of the program will be here, and we'll hear about the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, and also we'll hear a Muslim perspective on the planned burning of a Quran by a Christian evangelical in Florida. Those discussions begin at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 60 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high of 73. Clear skies tonight and a low of 48. Sunshine for Friday and a nice day with a high of 75. There is a slight chance of rain for Saturday.
Support for WOSU comes from the law firm Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, offering legal services to Central Ohio since 1936. Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, big enough to win, small enough to care. On the web at isaacbrandt.com.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Before we move on, I want to let you know that if you're interested in volunteering at North Central, you can go to North Central Services. SuicidePreventionServices.org. SuicidePreventionServices.org. They have a class starting up at the end of September, and there's still room. So if you want to get involved that way. Also, their suicide prevention hotline is 614-221-5445. That's 614-221-5445. And joining us now is Jack Marshall. He's a former television news anchor in northeastern Ohio. He suffered from depression for many, many years and has said the stigmas kept him from seeking treatment. He is now the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Ohio's stigma buster. Jack, welcome to the show.
I appreciate you offering me the invitation, and it is a privilege to be on your show. Thank you.
You bet. You struggled with depression and thoughts of suicide for many years. Did you know that you suffered from a mental illness?
You know, I really didn't think of it in those terms because that sounds so, you know, to the layperson, so drastic. I now know that I did suffer from it, and I always say that it's lurking over my shoulder. Of course, to some people that may sound like, wow, you're really paranoid, but I think when you go through the darkness of depression and thoughts of suicide and those traditional unfortunate, terrible stigma related thoughts that you do have when you go through depression, you're afraid. You just never want to go back there. You just want to do anything and everything you can to stay away from that dark corner of the world, if you will. And so at any rate, you know, I guess I feel like I am, quote unquote, normal, although we all know that none of us are normal.
Define normal. Yeah.
What is normal?
Right.
But I knew at the time that I was going through this, I had thoughts, which I've spoken to, and I've spoken of melancholia through my younger days. But I knew in the mid-90s is when it really, really hit hard. I was down. I knew it wasn't a normal just being down, feeling blue. But I did not identify that it was a mental illness. I didn't identify, which I should have, that it was depression, because my parents had gone through the same thing. So it was a hereditary illness. It is a hereditary illness, and I wish that I would have identified it sooner.
But there was also the stigma that even if a lot of people know that there might be something very wrong, the idea of a mental illness is not the same thing as breaking your ankle.
It's not, and that's what I tell the story to many people about. It's not a knock against the medical community or anything like that. But I was getting checked by my medical doctor at the time. I wanted him to find something wrong with me, which is really something weird to say. But I thought if he could put a finger on what was causing my melancholia, my deep depression, you know, he'd give me a pill and I would feel better. When you have high blood pressure, you get a pill. God forbid, we all know a lot of people and loved ones that have suffered with cancer, and they go through chemo, they go through radiation, there's a protocol that they go through. When you're depressed, and much of it is because of the stigma in our society, even if you identify what you're going through, you just don't want to deal with it because of what you're afraid of what people will think.
So you've got the depression, and that's in and of itself. And then on top of that, you've got that feeling that you can't talk about it, and that can increase the depression.
It can. And, you know, it's a combination, too. It's a combination of being immobilized, which that's how I felt. I felt like you just can't. You don't know what to do. You know that you just feel powerless, I guess, is what depression does. It just wraps its arms around you, as I have said in the past, and it grabs hold of you, and it won't let go. And you have to sort of break free because you're not thinking properly. You're not thinking clearly at the time. And all you're thinking of is, geez, I wish this will go away, and maybe it will. And you're not thinking correctly. And then there's the stigma, too. Once you identify, you know, hey, this might be something mm-hmm. I need to see a psychiatrist about, you think, what are people going to think of me? What is my family going to think and my friends if they do find out? So you walk around with what I call a mask. You put on your happy face, and that's the worst thing that you could do because basically you're trying to be somebody else when you should be going to see a psychiatrist, you should be going to see a counselor, and you should be on medication so you can get better.
Now, you're one of those folks, you were one of the last people anyone would have ever imagined had suffered from depression.
That's true, because I'm such a chipper kind of guy. You ought to get to know me. I mean, I'm just a wonderful.
I've heard great things, Jack.
I'm one of the nicest guys in the world, and one of the most humble.
goes hand in hand.
They go hand in hand. And I grew up in a very normal, what I would consider family. My dad was a Cleveland firefighter. My mom was a stay-at-home mom back in the day, and a very normal middle-class family in the greater Cleveland area. And I grew up with that sense of humor that my dad had given me, and he always looked on the bright side. He always made jokes about things. And I inherited that. I also inherited his genes for depression, which I would rather have not received. But I guess mm-hmm. your point is well taken. I even would ask my psychiatrist at the time, do you think it hits somebody, do you think it hits me harder? Because I've always been an optimist. I have always been, I've always had that never-ending sense of humor, which my wife would wish would sometimes go away. And it's sort of like when someone of that nature is hit by depression, my unprofessional opinion is it's more of a shock. It's more of a shock that you're stymied for a while because you don't know what to do. I joke that if a mean person is depressed, it goes along with their nature. So it's no big deal if somebody of an optimistic, happy-go-lucky nature, which I guess I would with all due humility and in seriousness, I guess that's how I was. I was just always a happy, and I am. I'm just a happy-go-lucky kind of guy, always thankful for what I've been given in life. I've been very blessed with my family and God knows what else. And when it hit me, it was right between the eyes. It was really tough.
I'm going to take a few calls now, Jack, and we've got some emails, too. And the first call, I think, probably is directed toward our North Central mental health suicide prevention folks. Barb, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. I thought of calling before, but I'm afraid somebody will find out, like my boss or my family, that I called.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all I can say is, and I don't know, don't want to know where you work, who your boss is. You have to take care of yourself. If you were sick, if you had a disease, if you had a heart attack, then you wouldn't be making the decision for you. You would have to go to the hospital and have a heart doctor look at you. Mental illness is basically the same issue. You have to take care of yourself and be proactive. You can't worry about what people are going to think. I know that's a reality that we all have to deal with. Don't worry about what your boss is going to think or your friends are going to think or your family is going to think, because if you don't get help in a hurry. This is a life and death issue, and I think we all know that. And the thoughts of suicide and the thoughts of whatever mental illness you're dealing with, when mine was depression, you have to take care of yourself, and no one else is going to do that but you. So I know that that's easier said than done. I know you're concerned about what people are going to think, especially at your place of employment. But you know what? You are more important. You have to take care of yourself.
Barb, did that answer your question? Okay, Barb's not there. I just want to repeat the number. It's 614-221-5445 for the suicide prevention hotline. And Rick, did you want to?
And if Barb did call, everything that's totally confidential. The most we ever share is first names, just to make it easier to talk. So she did call, and we would listen and try to find whatever her situation is and get her help for it.
Yeah, you don't take information from the caller.
No.
Not identifying information, yeah.
Right.
Whatever they want to share. Right,
exactly. And you share information. Okay, that suicide prevention hotline, 614-221-5445. Dale, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My first two questions, briefly. The first question is from your expert's opinion, is depression, would it be defined as a chronic problem? And number two, would suicide be the ultimate worst-case scenario of long-term depression?
Hmm. Boy, I think the experts would know some of that better than someone like me that has suffered from depression. Is it chronic? I would say sure it is, because if you don't take care of it, if you don't go see someone, talk to someone, possibly get medication for it, it is going to come back. It may come and go. With me, I felt like I fell off a cliff, and I couldn't get out of the depression. Yeah, suicide, you know, the sad part is that death was, I often say, my constant companion, but it was, when I thought of death, I thought of relief, and I thought of happiness, because it would take the pain away. And I guess maybe in I wasn't thinking straight, but yet I think that's why we see suicide connected with depression and other forms of mental illness, because some way, somehow, many people think that's the only way out. And hopefully, if you get help before that, you realize there are other avenues that can get you make you better. But as I say, I think the experts know more about that than I do.
You know, Jack, in your bio that I was reading, you talked about how you would go to work and everyone called you Happy Jack at work, but at home you were like Catatonic Jack. And so when you talk about the worst scenario of depression, when you were at home around your kids, you said you missed a lot of that growing up.
I did, and I want to make sure wasn't when the kids were young and little, although there were times when I did feel, you know, a little more down than I should have been. It was really when they were of high school age.
Okay.
And it, you know what? It really doesn't matter, because there were times when the point of how old they were, the point of being a family man, having four children growing up, the age, I think as they get older, I was always active with my kids and involved in what they were doing. And when you're a parent, it's a 24/7 job for mom and dad. And I was very much involved with their lives. And so it was as much of a painful process when they were of high school age, because they were so active. They were doing different things. The one story that I do tell is that when they would do silly things, and of course in high school, in grade school, when they were becoming a teenager, they would do things that should have been funny. And I always would say that funny things would make me sad, which is odd, and then the sad things would make me sadder. And I really struggled with that. I really felt like I did miss out on some of the happier moments, to the more milestone moments that they were going through. I was concerned about myself, and that is so selfish, but yet I I didn't know what to do at the time, and I was concerned because it was just I wanted everybody to go away so I could go crawling in a corner, but then I had to go back to work the next day after not sleeping all night. So it was. So if you talk about a vicious circle, or a dog or cat chasing its tail, that's exactly the scenario that I was in going through depression. And I did miss a lot when the kids were in those teen years, and I feel bad about that. But you know what? I took care of business as best that I could, and I got better.
Rick, did you want to say something?
No, I listened to what he said about the seeing people happy made him sadder.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the spring, the situation with everything blossoming, and so contrary to how you're feeling that, you know, it works the opposite.
We were talking about how the incidence of suicide increases in the spring, Jack.
It is a reality, and I think whether or not it's true, the same I've always heard about the holiday season, people being depressed, and I think it's because exactly what your panel there would say, it's how you're supposed to feel. You're supposed to be happier around the holidays. Of course, we know families are dysfunctional and they're always fighting under normal circumstances. But that's supposed to bring out the best in us. When you get up in the morning, the commercials show everybody, you know, opening the drapes and taking that deep breath before you pass out or whatever and get ready for work. And the same thing can be said about the change of seasons. I mean, I would not look forward to spring simply because I could not take advantage mm-hmm. of those positive feelings. I didn't have that within me, and it makes you more depressed, if I can say that, than you already are. And you think a lot of times that you've hit bottom, and then things mm-hmm. like a change of a season, or a child crying, or not being able to care for your kids, it really makes it even worse.
That's all the time we have, Jack Marshall. I want to thank you, Ohio Stigma Buster, for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. And if the folks who are listening have any questions, they need to call somebody and they need to take care of themselves.
Okay. And also thank you, Mary Brennan Hoffman of the North Central Mental Health Suicide Prevention Services and Rick Baumann of the North Central Mental Health Suicide Prevention Services. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having us on.
It's all the time we have
thank
for
you.
All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.